they're watching.
Call the meeting to order of March the 10th. Today's a work session. Our alcalde, Mayor Mark Shelton, is very sick. He won't be able to join us today. Also, Alderman Randy O'Donnell is, she is arriving late. She already, I think, participated on the OASA, got this presentation, so she's going to join us a little bit later. And we're waiting for Alderman Brown. And there she is.
So, right on cue.
Just like in church, on time.
That's Mr. Manager.
Okay. This is a report from OASA on the proposed changes in the water conservation standards. And as you mentioned, Ms. O'Donnell did have the opportunity to hear this presentation. A couple of us came back for a second time, Ed, so we ought to get some extra points for that. I think everybody knows Ed Carwin, our executive director of OASA, and he has a presentation for you all, and then I think the OASA folks will be prepared to answer questions that you all might have. Ed?
Yes, thanks, Steve. I have just a few remarks, and then I'm going to turn it over to Al Reimer, who's on our board, who chaired the committee that did all the heavy lifting on this work. Just a little bit of a background. The drought of 2001-2002 was really an eye-opening event for us. It really pointed out the vulnerabilities to our system and improvements that we had to make, and really recommitment to conservation as one of the cornerstones to our water supply future. So, and during the drought of 2001-2002, our supply got down to about 32% of its capacity. And compared to our neighbors at that time, we were in worse shape than most. But that call to order did put in place some really important initiatives that served us extremely well in the most recent drought. The OASA board adopted a conservation pricing structure in 2002. In January 2003, there was a joint meeting in the OASA board, in the Carborough, Chapel Hill, Orange County boards, much like we had just a week ago, where we presented some recommendations for improvements to our conservation standards and ordinances to include year-round conservation measures, drought or no drought. And those were all adopted by the OASA board, this board, Chapel Hill and Orange County in 2003, and that's what's currently in place and, of course, the topic of tonight's meeting. We began recycling high-quality water at the Jones Ferry Road Water Treatment Plant just down the street. We pump additional water from the reservoirs because we use it to clean filters at the plant and other process purposes, and that water is very clean, and it used to be discharged to an intermittent creek here in town. Now we recycle that water. Almost 90% of that water is recycled, and that allows us to reduce pumping from the reservoir. So that was a really important water-saving measure. And then finally, we agreed in 2006 with the university to construct and put in service a reclaimed water system. Reclaimed water is highly treated water from our Mason Farm wastewater treatment plant, which will be used for non-drinking purposes on campus. And I'm pleased to report that project's on budget, it's on schedule, and we're doing operational startup as we speak. Additional measures to improve the reliability of our service, and as well as conserve, the OASA board in 2007 decided to send even a stronger price signal to individually metered residential customers to conserve, and we implemented a tiered or increasing block rate structure. And that is, the more water you use, the unit cost for that water increases pretty substantially. And that's been really effective at reducing demand. To improve our reliability, we invested over $4 million building a pump station at our quarry reservoir. This is a, when full, it holds about 200 million gallons. It's kind of our backup contingency supply. During the drought of 2001-2002, we did not have an easy way to access that water. Now we do. We have a pump station. We could pump it directly to the water plant. And we also improved our ability to receive drinking water from the city of Durham during emergencies, and about $1.5 million was invested in that. The drought of 2007-2008, at its low point, we still had 40% of our supply left. And unlike the drought of 2001-2002, we were in very good shape compared to our neighbors. And Steve, I know you heard me say this three times at the joint meeting on February 5th, but for fiscal year 2010, this fiscal year coming up, we're expecting to sell 16% less water than we did 10 years ago, even though we have 3,100 new customers. So that really is a testimony to the conservation ethic in our community and all the measures we have put in place. And that certainly is an important part of why we see our annual water sales not only slow in growth and flatten, but actually decline, particularly with the startup of the reclaimed water system, where we expect that about 600,000 gallons a day, the university will replace drinking water with this high-quality reclaimed water. We have some things we're still actively working on. I mentioned the startup, the reclaimed water system. We also are working on updating our long-term water supply plan. We expect to complete most of the technical work on that study this summer, and then present to the local government some of the significant findings and recommendations of that. And, of course, the subject of tonight's meeting is implementing additional changes and improvements in the conservation ordinance. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Al Reimer.
Thanks. It's good to be before you again. I was trying to remember the last time I was here doing something. It's good to see those of you that I know and those that I haven't had a chance to meet. It's nice to be here. Just a little break from this for a moment. We had a conference in Clemens, North Carolina today in which Pat Davis spoke along with Sally Hoyt from the university on the reclaimed water system that Ed's talked about. And I wish we had a chance to show that to you tonight. It is the most exciting thing that's going to happen in this community in terms of reducing over the long period of time the amount of water that the community is going to use. The fact that stuck in my mind that I'd actually forgotten about is that it will defer the addition to the water plant that will need to be done for 15 years because of that. It's just quite phenomenal, actually.
Al.
Yes.
That includes Carolina North?
No. The Carolina North is another project that the university is talking with Owasso about, looking at the potential of building a satellite wastewater plant up there, which could then be used to reclaim water from the development of that campus and recycle it, but it's totally separate.
Okay.
It's just the campus use and the fields and stuff. A little bit of background on the conservation standards. As you all know, in 2003, you and the other boards adopted the what are our current conservation standards. And after the 2007-2008 drought, we committed to going back and looking at those ordinances because of lessons learned. There were some things done in the ordinance that probably didn't work quite as well as they could have, and we found that out going through this 2008 drought. We also very actively solicited feedback from the community. We had a number of different meetings. We come to the boards and ask for guidance from them on what folks saw as not as well put as it could have been. We got a lot of different comments from a variety of different people, including the green industry, meaning the folks that do landscaping and the like. And what you'll see as a result of that is manifested in what are now the revisions to the ordinance. Outdoor use, surprisingly, constitutes only 7% of Owasso's total annual water demand. It just so happens it all comes in kind of a crunched up time in the summer when there's a lot of other water use, which is primarily the university with their cooling towers, which is exactly what this new project is going to help to reduce. What's really interesting, though, is after the 2007-08 drought, our customers continued to reduce the amount of water that was being used. You might have remembered seeing that on the graph that Ed done. And at that time, of course, there was very little outdoor use. What that said to all of us was that there's a significant conservation ethic that's been built into this, into the community.
Before you leave that slide, could you go back to that slide, Alan? And I guess my question is, how did Owasso calculate it was only 7%?
Mm-hmm. How did we calculate that it's only 7%? Well, I'm not sure how to navigate back, so I'll just say it. It's a relatively easy number to calculate when you look at the average use. If you look at, you take kind of a typical bell-shaped curve during the summer months, you can look at the water use for the community, and it's relatively flat on both sides, and then it builds up in the summertime. We know what the university is using by metering as a result of the cooling towers, so the delta in that is essentially irrigation use.
Okay.
So, and that's how that number was basically arrived at. It's a little more sophisticated than that, but that's basically how it was arrived at.
Can I ask you a question, too?
Sure.
What about, like, apartments? How do you know? Because they use irrigation, many of them, right?
Yes, but it's relatively small. Some apartments are master metered, and some are individually metered, and then there's a master meter, not a master meter, but a bigger meter for the common spaces in the apartment. Clearly nobody's watering their lawns inside their apartments, but for the apartment project that's master metered, you'd get the same effect as you would in a home in the summertime. You'd get an increased use if they're watering their lawns or trees. If they have a separate meter for just the common spaces in the apartment, you'd see the same effect. It would just be the lower level. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So you measure that. I mean, it's all the metered.
All of the metered data was evaluated
7%.
In the process. Okay. So, I mean, it's probably off, maybe a fraction of a percent, but probably not much more than that.
Al, it's Dan.
Yes.
You refer to the 7%, I think, is only 7%, implying, I think, that that's a small proportion of our total water usage. And I want to make sure, A, that I'm interpreting that correctly, and, you know, maybe this is something you're going to further in the presentation, but is there an implication? Does that necessarily imply that the number itself in terms of the actual water being used is not a significant number?
No, I didn't mean it quite that way. I guess if I would have, I didn't write these slides, I would probably not have used the word only in the sense that you've interpreted, and I think that's a correct interpretation of what it would sound like. The reality is that 7% of our total water is allocated to watering lawns and trees and things, and you'll see how we went in on the new conservation standard and tried to interdict for those things that are important, bushes and trees, and said lawns can die. But there is a certain amount that this community, I believe, values in the way of green. And so some water is going to be used, except in the most extreme kind of situations, I think, for watering. If I've not properly answered that, when we get to that section, we'll go back over that.
Thank you.
I think it's also important that the focus on outdoor use in terms of overall conservation will probably have less impact than actually working with the homeowners and the apartments and the rest to reduce the amount of water that they use, because it's 93% of the use, will make a much greater impact if we're able to get them to conserve, as we've been able to do. Earlier tonight, Ed alluded to the tiered rates and the impact that they've had on our ability to cut back, particularly during the summertime. And I'm reminded we're currently doing a water reuse study for the firm I work for in Brentwood, Tennessee. You may know that that's right outside of Knoxville, and it's a big area for stars for the country and Western and the like. There are, at last count, about 300 customers that use 15,000 gallons a day in the summertime to water their lawn.
Jeez.
I mean, you talk about profligate waste to water these. And we look at, I don't know how many customers we've currently got that are over, 5,000, and you can count them on a couple of hands. So conservation does matter, and I think we've done a pretty good job of beginning to make that happen. Mandatory restrictions are only but one of the several important tools. We've alluded, both Ed and I, to this issue of tiered water rates, which make a real significant difference. In the public hearings that we had, we listened to the customers. Some we didn't particularly agree with. Don't tell us how much water to use, just tell us how much it'll cost. Well, that was why I used the Brentwood example. Excuse me, but it's one thing to say that you can afford to spend for 15,000 gallons of water a month for your lawn, but is that good when it comes to the overall public good? And I think our response to that is no, and that's why we have tiered rates, and it costs more if you use a lot of water. Certain restrictions appear to be fairly, they targeted certain kinds of users, and they had an unintended consequences and with marginal benefits, and I'll point out a couple of those in just a moment. We also heard from the green industry, and I think this is, we all said it was like an aha. You know, trees and shrubs and bushes that take a long time to develop can be impacted significantly by not being watered, whereas grass can come back. You know, it's expendable even. It can be replanted. But some of these bushes that are trees that have been around for a real long period of time need to have water, maybe not as much as they'd like, but they do need to have water. What we've done in terms of changes to the ordinance that we're looking for approval to, the first was to do away with a water supply advisory. The reason we did that is it was year-round. I mean, it didn't mean anything. It people said, oh, what's an advisory? You know, why do we have this? It's just it was redundant, and it tended to confuse the citizens with, and we heard this from citizens. We used to have high caps on monthly residential water use. As I said, they don't matter anymore because the water is so bloody expensive when it gets into that upper tier that there's just virtually, did anybody last year touch that? Nobody touched that upper tier.
There might have been a couple that we made contact with, and they could explain it, yeah, or they knew to stop it.
And
it was minimal.
They wrote a big check once, not twice. The other thing that we heard was that, and this happened to come up during both a botanical garden situation and the Chapel Hill when they were building the new Southern Park, the fields were to be sodded, but it was going to come at a time when there was virtually no water. And at that particular point in time, when we declared those water shortages, it would have significantly impacted the ability for that park to come online this year, which it did. And the university had some issues with that also. So what we've done in this recommended changes to the ordinance is that for public purpose fields, not for your backyard where you play badminton or, you know, a pickup game of soccer, but for public purpose fields, what we're suggesting is, except at the very high end of the water emergency, that these fields be allowed to be watered, provided that there's an approved water conservation plan that's in place. And go ahead.
I noticed that the public purpose athletic recreation field specifically excluded golf courses, and I guess that's because, well, there's Finley, and maybe they're using reclaimed water anyway, or is that
don't fire? Wish they're using Morgan. They're using Morgan Creek, so they are using reclaimed water. It's coming right out of our wastewater treatment plant and into their intake and being watered on the golf course. We wish it was a pipe coming out of ours with a meter on it that we could then charge them for it. But in fact, they're using Morgan Creek, and the Chapel Hill Country Club, which is the other major golf course, uses the stream flow. In the drought last year, they came to us and said, could we buy potable water and fill our lakes? And I don't know. I'm not quite sure I remember what the staff's reaction was, but it was like, what? So that didn't happen. And they'll have to have their own contingency plans, which means more storage in all likelihood, or the purchase of reclaimed water, which they can then put into the lake.
Do you know the public purpose fields, what proportion of that 7% usage?
No, I don't know.
Do you know that?
No, I don't know right off the top of my head. Okay. I do know that when they were initially establishing Southern Community Park, that they were using a few hundred thousand gallons of water a day for that period when they were establishing that turf. But it was a critical time. There were hot conditions, but it was a limited period as well.
To put in perspective, though, maybe this will help you visualize it. A typical golf course in a summer day requires about 100,000 gallons of water a day. And so that would be a lot of big fields. I would think it would take much less than that. I just happen to know that fact. But so I don't think it's anywhere near approaching that in terms of what would be required for probably all the fields in Chapel Hill and Carborough were they to be watered. because I don't think we have that much green space and fields between the two communities. As I mentioned earlier, we're recommending that there be fewer changes on the irrigation of trees and shrubs and gardens, but that there be no change in the restrictions on watering lawns. One that came as a real surprise, whoops, all right, I punched the, all right, let me try page up. Okay, here we go. The one that came as a surprise to a lot of us had come from folks who have swimming pools, and I'm at the bottom now, had swimming pools, and were saying that in order, and this came really from the town of Chapel Hill, you know, we've got this new swimming pool, we need to fill it with water, and then we need to keep it topped off. We did a study of the pools that we went onto the aerial photographs that we had, GIS, computed the surface area of the amount of pool area in the communities, looked at the evaporation rate, and decided that the amount of water to refill and keep those pools full, except during a water supply emergency, was so small it's noise in the system. I mean, it's not that the pumps would leak that much in their seals, but the reality is it was a very small quantity of water. On the other side of that, though, are the ornamental ponds and fountains, and what we've suggested there is that we change that so that during stage one drought they could be filled, but that there be no change in the ordinance with respect to stages two, three, or an emergency storage, which seemed reasonable in light of, again, the number of ponds and the like that we've got. The other thing we got a lot of feedback from in the public hearings was the issue related to spray cleaning houses before the houses are painted. Prior to this, you couldn't clean a house, and therefore you couldn't paint it in the summertime. And what we're recommending is that because of the quantity of water that's being used, stages one and two, they could do it, but not during stage three. But something that came out of the county, the joint hearing, which is a really good idea, is to advertise to those who do clean houses that they can go get reclaimed water in bulk at the wastewater treatment plant. So that'll be done to those people that do cleaning so that maybe they won't use water anyway. Because most of the house cleaning only takes between 100 and 250 gallons, and that's not too large a tank for some of these trucks to carry. What are the next steps? We're looking for comments and questions tonight. And then the adoption of the revised conservation standards at an upcoming board meeting, and we anticipate that being our second board meeting of the month, which is, I believe, the 26th of March. We'd then ask you to incorporate those revised conservation standards into your local ordinance. And then we would take all of that, the fact that you all had integrated them, Chapel Hill, the county, and submit those as part of OWASA's local water shortage response plan, which is due to the state by July the 1st of this coming year as a result of last year's drought legislation. So we're moving in the path of having that happen, and that's why we're here tonight, to see what you guys have got to say, guys and gals have got to say. So we're here to answer questions.
Yeah, I have a question going back to the point on the caps on monthly residential water use. I think from Ed's comment that it sounds like the people who are in that status were contacted personally, is that right, by staff? And is that something you would continue to do, that there would be a certain threshold of use that as a matter of policy you would contact the homeowner or whoever the user is and talk to them about their water usage?
Yes, as a matter of practice, but as Al said, the price signal is just so incredibly strong, particularly with these surcharges that are part of our rate structure when there's declared shortages, that the bill will definitely get their attention. But the answer is yes, we would continue to make personal contact.
Thanks.
I'd like to add to that, too. I think what's important is that we didn't just do this during this particular drought. We've done it in the previous drought also to help the homeowners understand that they've created themselves a real problem. And then we didn't have the pricing, tiered pricing that we did then, but we still contacted homeowners saying, look, you're using an awful lot of water here. So I think that as a policy matter, it seems we've been doing that even prior to this last drought.
Yeah, we, last summer, my husband left a hose on all day, for like 24 hours, and the letters are really, really effective, and so is the so is the cost.
And the graph in the bill.
We don't leave the hose on all day anymore. Not that we ever did.
The universe.
But I had a question. I will remember it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I guess I want to be clear on the point, the change with the swimming pools as opposed to the ornamental ponds or the washing the building exteriors. Am I understanding correctly that the swimming pools, whether it's filling or refilling or topping off, it's much smaller amount of water use than any of those other categories, and that's why you feel like you can have a more liberal standard?
Yes, that's the case. They're,
430% of the total outdoor use, what, May through September. We estimate it to be only 3% of the total outdoor use during the summer is pools.
Okay.
They're, 437 pools in the communities in Orange County total, including the public pools.
Okay. Thank you.
I remembered my question. I've been noticing that we're already down this year, not our lakes, but that we're down in the rainfall amount. Is that right?
Yes.
Noticed that we're down like 2-point-some inches, and it's just the middle of March. That's unusual for March, right? Is it?
It's unusual, but not unusual given what we've seen over the past decade. We have ups and downs, but
right. So we predict. Are we able to predict any kind of change in? Because then we were all freaked out, and then the rains came, kind of not what we were expecting them. Are we able to predict any kind of shift in what the rain patterns are, or is that just too unknown?
It's really interesting. There, if you look at the patterns, there's weather and then there's climate.
Right.
And it would seem to me that the issue of with respect to predicting where we're headed in terms of rainfall and the like on a long-term pattern is climate. And for those that have followed the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their prediction for the Southeast is that our rainfall will be about the same in terms of total amount of rain, but it's going to come in flashier storms. So we're going to have more intense storms over in contracted periods of time. What that means is that we're all going to have to reexamine our storage strategies. Because right now our storage strategy has been built on the historical rainfall patterns we've had that we've recorded over a period of 80 or so years. We may find that that strategy has to be modified as we learn more about what's happening in the climate. But we're only seeing a few, we're looking at a microcosm of that. We're looking at 10% of, even less than 10% of our current record. So unless Ed, you or Pat have got a crystal ball, I think we're kind of, and I don't mean that lightly, I don't think we really know yet.
Because it would make a difference. I mean, if we were able to say, the annual pattern is shifting somewhat, then it would make a difference in how we managed water, and I think it would make a difference in our panicking. Like if we knew, this is what it's like now, but this is when it's going to come. But that's just.
Well, I think we'll see this summer. We'll see. We're going to have a little bit of a relief valve this summer as the university brings the cooling towers online. That's going to make it's going to give us a little bit of cushion that we haven't seen in the past. and we'll be able to make an assessment next year that may be different than where mm-hmm. we sit this year. Because as that seasonal use of those cooling towers comes on, it's May kind of to September, October is when that curve is the steepest, because that's when it's the hottest, and the cooling towers are running. If we get a lot of rain during that period or a little rain, we'll begin to see that this year. But it's going to be weather. It's not going to be climate.
Thank you.
Okay, these
standards are, I really appreciate them. I can tell, Ed, your staff and you did a lot of work in kind of responding to the needs of that came up over the last several months with the water shortage and so on, particularly the like the painters and the swimming pools and landscape folks. I wondered, were there any groups of workers or any industries or any occupations that weren't able to be addressed by some of the concerns that we heard over the last several months, or were you able to pretty much address most of what we heard over the last several months?
Speaking for the folks on the, I think, and the staff, and I think we tried to address every single comment we got from anybody that offered it either publicly or in writing. We got lots of emails. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was one group that didn't come in and express the, you know, concerns that we didn't try and address. And I think the most vocal in terms of the overall thing were the folks that were taking care of lawns and mm-hmm. gardens and the like. And they were very helpful in their suggestions. There was a task force set up by AWASA. They invited them in more than just the public hearings. They came in and actually had meetings with the staff to address ways to deal with these issues, which was really, you know, going out, I think, and reaching out to the stakeholders to try and get that information rather than expecting them to, you know, just come to us.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
I guess my next sort of question is, how much cushion is the reclaimed water going to provide, do you think?
Initially, 600,000 gallons. Ultimately, it could be, with all the other things that the university contemplates, it could be up in the range of 1 million, 1.5 million gallons a day. That's substantive. Mm-hmm. It is really substantive. And I don't know, see if I can go back. Too far. If you look at this curve, which Ed showed before, I was thinking that was a pointer. If you look at the line, this was kind of the way the water was, we were using water from 1985 on. And, you know, back when we did the master plan update in the late 1990s and early 2000, this curve kind of just went on just like this, you know, all the way up here. And we were looking at planning for storage. And then look what happened here in the drought. And then look what happened here with all the conservation messages that were delivered. And then look to the question you ask, look at what happens when the reclaimed water comes online. And as they use more and more reclaimed water on the university system, this line isn't going to just, it won't go down and go to zero, but it's certainly going to go down, and then you'll see a slight increase as the community develops further. But I think those curves are very telling about where we are and the fact that, as Ed mentioned, you have, you know, here we are a decade later, and we're using 16% less water than we used before, and we've gained over 3,000 customers. That says a lot for the citizens that are conserving the water. It really does. I can also say that this is an area that I practice in as a professional engineer. I've looked at ordinances from all over this country and some from Australia, and I have not found an ordinance that is as thoughtful and as complete as this particular ordinance is. It's a credit to the staff for the work that they did developing it, quite frankly, and is really, you'd think California and Arizona would have really strict ordinances. I go on and Google one of the cities, Google Phoenix, and look at their water reuse or their water conservation ordinance, and you'd be stunned. It's two pages. It's meaningless. So I think there's been a lot of work done by the staff and by the AWASA board to make it fair, but also to send a signal to people, thou shalt not use too much water because it's a precious resource and we just don't have that much more of it. And because we're at the top of the Piedmont Crescent, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, and us, and Durham, are all at the tippy top of watersheds, we don't have more places to build reservoirs. We're out of space. So we really have to think about this conservation in a way that communities that are further south don't on the rivers don't have to worry about.
A question. Jackie was talking about panicking. Now that I remarry, have six kids, I do panic every time I get my water bill. And it seems like we are victims of our own success when it comes to our conservation ethic, because it is, it's not as a compliment. I mean, I think we have an excellent water system, and but I think that the pricing is going to continue to increase. The more we save, the more expensive it's always going to get. And do you project, do you have an idea of what kind of prices increases are consumers looking at with the 16% reduction on sales? And
there is a reduction, and you've seen it, and that was why there was such a large increase last year. A lot of communities are able to take, we'll take a neighbor, Durham and Raleigh. Those cities have embedded within their cities their water and sewer utilities. So they're part of the city government. They are not an authority like Owosso is. So part of their funds to run those systems come from the general fund. So they don't price water at the cost of water. They price water at whatever's politically expedient. And that's not a slam against either of them, but that's the reality of it. And if you look at where our water lies within most of the major utilities in the state of North Carolina, we're kind of in the middle. There's some that are double what we are, frankly. I think the answer to your question is yes, it's had a significant impact. That is why there was such a tremendous rate increase last year. We have an obligation, because we don't have general funds that we can pump into, help build the money up to do the, you know, to keep our rates. We have an obligation to our bondholders, who may be some of all of us, to keep a certain capital reserve. Beyond that, we spend what we spend for chemicals and staff and all the rest of that. And the reality is, if we can't make up that difference, we have to go to the ratepayers with it. Now, this year, we're looking to minimize to the absolute extent that we can any kind of an increase in water rates. We expect that the offset that with the university buying less water, we've already factored that in for this year. So the rates that we're currently paying have factored in the reduction that the university will bring to the table, because they're going to be using reclaimed water instead of buying 400,000 to 600,000 gallons a day of potable water. That's what, about $1 million, Pat, I saw today? It's about $1 million of revenue that we're not going to get. Now, there's some revenue comes back in from the reclaimed water that we're selling to them, but the delta is not 100%. In other words, we're not recovering dollar for dollar what's there. And the reason we're not is that the university paid for the entire capital cost of the system. So we as ratepayers for Owosso did not have to pay to build that reclaimed water system. The university made a significant capital investment. They are paying what we call in the field true cost of service for supplying them that reclaimed water. So they're not getting a break on the water rate itself. But there's no, in that water rate, there is no capital amortization, because they amortize the entire capital by not charging it. We get the whole asset back, though, as a utility, and we'll then maintain it and charge them for the maintenance of that system. But you're spot on with respect to the fact that we have seen a significant reduction in our costs or our revenue. And our costs for chemicals in this last year alone are up, and some chemicals up 100%. And chemicals are, outside of electricity, and staff are our highest cost for operation. And, you know, we got to add the chemicals to make the water clean. That's how it all works. So there are pressures in a lot of different directions from it. It's an awful long answer to a good question, actually.
And I really think the university, I mean, we all subsidize the university, and all the taxpayers of North Carolina pay for the university, and we're going to get a reduction in consumption from them. I think they should still to pay.
Well, they're paying the true cost that it costs us to make that water for them. And we all subsidize, I guess, as citizens of the state of North Carolina, we did subsidize the water main and the pumping station and the rest of it. But, you know, at least we didn't do that as ratepayers. So.
Jackie?
This is off topic, or it's off this topic, but I have you here right now. At the end of the month, we're going to be meeting with the university and their financial consultants to look at the financial impact of Carolina North on the municipalities. Will Carolina North be paying Owosso hookup fees?
There's no reason why they wouldn't. They're a customer just like we are, okay. As individual customers.
So Carolina North will pay, even though they're a university, Carolina North will pay Owosso hookup fees.
They pay them now. When they bring a building online, they pay for that. They pay as an Owosso customer does.
Thank you. I've been asking that question for 5 years, and I've never gotten a straight answer.
What will be interesting is if as I said before, as Carolina North develops and we begin to look at the potential for the use of reclaimed water there, you know, there'll be some joint discussions about how to deal with the cost for that kind of a facility. The university has not pledged, but I think is aiming in the direction of dual plumbing, which means that toilets could be flushed with reclaimed water instead of, you know, potable water. What an absolute waste. So I think there's some changes that we'll see. The state plumbing code has to be changed to reflect some of that, but I don't think that's an impediment that can't be overcome. And I think from what I've seen of the plans that they have for water conservation, it would extend to Carolina North, you know, in spades.
They're doing some amazing things now right on old campus.
Yes,
so.
They are.
Yeah.
And so with the new construction, they have an opportunity to do a lot of things that rain harvesting, for example, which is relatively difficult to do on the old campus, but they're doing it.
Yeah.
Absolutely, in four or five different locations. Mm-hmm. But at Carolina North, it's just integrated into the whole system analysis. It's a holistic approach to not only the concept of conservation, but the concept of what kind of water can we use to cut back on the amount of potable that's necessary.
Great. You saved me 15 minutes at the next meeting. Thanks, Alan.
Yeah.
Are there any more questions?
Yes. I have a comment. I guess I just wanted to echo kind of what you said a few minutes ago and give you all props for this work, because I feel like I read in, you know, whatever it is I read on the web and whatnot, it seems like there's a new story every week about water supply problems, problems of privatization of water supplies all around the planet. And I think the leadership that Owosso and our communities are providing in having a self-sufficient water supply that's managed publicly for the public good, I think is really important for the world at this time. And so, I read this document and I felt like this was really excellent work on the part of the staff and the Owosso board. And wanted to thank you all for that.
We'll take that message back. We appreciate your saying that. That's very nice. Okay.
I take that as a
moving the resolution accepting the report, yes.
We move and second. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thanks so much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Let's keep going right on.
Okay. If I could ask the board, if you all are interested in having any kind of conversation, you might think about it now. You have at your places a memo from Adina Messinger that you also were emailed earlier today about some STPDA funds through the stimulus package. And I apologize for the very short notice, but we just got information the end of last week. We met as a staff on Friday, and Adina, along with help from some other staff folks, put together this memo to get out to you all today with our suggestions on how to to spend roughly $404,000 in funding that will come through the MPO. Adina's here. If you all have questions or you know, any concerns about what's being proposed, I'd appreciate if we could take a couple minutes and talk about that before we move on to the other work session.
Can we do that?
Sure.
Do you need any action from us?
Not unless you all choose to do that. But we didn't want to go in there tomorrow without you all having had an opportunity
to see it. Action saying these are the projects we want. No.
Okay. I don't think so, but you're certainly welcome to do that. If there's an issue with it, we want to know about it.
Let me ask the question: is there somebody who completely disagrees with this?
No.
Who has serious concerns with this staff recommendation?
No, it's fine.
That's
no.
Great.
Go with it.
It's good.
I saw the question for Steve.
Okay.
Steve, does this have budgetary implications for the 09-10 budget in terms of some of the work we would have done, whether it's on planning or right-of-way for some of these sidewalks or whatever it might have been?
We haven't had a chance to really go into detail on that. I think the short answer is probably not any significant impact. I think it'll help us keep our projects going, and it may mean revamping what we're doing with the bond anticipation notes, but right now we don't see a significant change.
Okay, and this has nothing to do with any of our other STPDA funds that weren't expected.
No, we're still, for example, in 10-11, we're still looking at Wilson Park Estes Drive connection and the Rogers Road sidewalks. Mm-hmm. Those are still programmed for 10-11 through the normal funds.
Thank you.
Okay.
So just for those who are watching at home, what we just discussed is a staff recommendation on how to, talking about almost $500,000 from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, thanks to President Obama leadership, and this will have a direct impact in Carrboro infrastructure. Thank you, Adina.
I want to take a minute to thank George and Adina and all the folks who have been working on James Street, because for the last 2.5 weeks, people are using that sidewalk. And I can't tell you, between people walking and running and walking dogs, and it's been used every day, and people are really pleased with it. So just thank you. I know it's still a work in progress, but it's in use already. Thanks.
Manager,
thank you for that. The next item is a retreat follow-up, and this is to consider a report from staff regarding those follow-up items that you all discussed at the February 2nd. Retreat. And if I could ask, Dean Rennick has two subject matters that are somewhat detailed. There are lengthy attachments in the packet. She had a presentation on those two items that we'd like to share with you. And then what we'd ask from you all, obviously, any questions you have on those two items. And then if we could ask you to look at those other items that we reported to you and things that we're asking clarification, if there's any more clarification you'd like to give, or if you have questions about any of our responses, we've got, I think, all the
what were those two items? Was one on the banking?
One is the banking. The other one is buying local.
Okay. I'm interested in the buying local. I felt like the banking thing was pretty clear.
Yeah.
But if Jackie wants a presentation. Okay.
Okay.
It's not a long presentation.
Okay.
All right.
There's no game tonight.
Right.
First, we'll start with exploring local preferential purchasing. And what you all asked us to do was do some type of cost analysis. So I spent a little bit of time looking at our expenditures over all funds last year, last fiscal year through June 30th, 2008. And really, out of the $17.5 million that we spent last year, 61% is for personnel and debt service. The other 6.8, representing 40% of total expenditure, then I broke it down and said, okay, what portion of that is spent within Orange County and outside of Orange County? And $2.5 million of that $6.8 million is spent within Orange County. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. Within Orange County, Out of the 2.5 million, a little over 2 million is really about interagency cooperation or shared services. And examples up there include transit, landfill fee, utilities, nonprofits, revolving loans, and we had one unusual grant expenditure for Greg Barber. And then the other half million or so is on miscellaneous purchases, including fleet and building maintenance supplies, office supplies, printing, graphics, the gym fitness, parking lot leases, and a lot of professional services, architects, attorneys, and consultants. Outside of Orange County, really what we're looking at are a number of large or unusual capital expenditures, such as vehicle and heavy equipment. An example would be the solid waste refuse truck, the sewer outfall construction, the generator at the Century Center, and the sidewalk construction. And then another large group of expenditures are around contractual services or operational costs. We've been doing a lot of capital projects that involve design, engineering, architectural costs, planning costs. We also pay for auditors, attorneys, seasonal labor for public works. We have a lot of expenditures around workers' compensation insurance and property insurance, utilities, and fuel. What, really, I think the point of looking at all those different types of expenditures, it makes us think about the kinds of things that we do have to consider when we're buying, when we're making purchasing decisions. Our overriding guidelines are the North Carolina purchasing laws, which there are numerous thresholds and guidelines based on the cost and the type of expenditure. Steps can include advertising, sealed bid. In the case of informal bid, you can get several quotes. They all require some level of outreach to the market, whether it be local or outside of Orange County. Another guideline we have are state contract and piggybacking, and both of those are examples of where the state or another municipality has already done the bidding, and we can piggyback off of their work, their bidding work. But the bottom line of that, common denominator in all of that, is that the lowest responsive bid is selected. And then we also go through a number of RFQs, where requests for qualification. This is primarily in design, planning, engineering, and that's where the selection criteria are focused on expertise, not necessarily just cost. But in any case, I believe that the purchasing processes, all of these, are an ongoing means of reaching out to the market, potentially the local market, for services and goods by the town. And as I wrote in the report that you have at your desk, there are lots of decisions that go into anything that we buy in the town. Cost has been a big factor. The location, there are a number of employees that work in the field or in the office that have procurement cards, and so that enables them to go to local stores to buy something that may, you know, a part that they may need to do their day-to-day work. Also, product availability is important. And again, whether a product is available on state contract or piggybacking, and the type of expertise needed is important in making some of our decisions. And again, a number of vendors that are capable of providing a good or service may be limited.
Yeah. Would you say when the procurement cards are used that staff looks first to Carver or Orange County to use those?
Well, yeah. I think that particularly when I analyze the procurement card spending, a lot of it is in fleet maintenance, and a lot of the fleet maintenance expenditures are within Carver because there are several auto goods stores here in town. A number of people buy office supplies. We have a Staples here, but there are also some right outside of Orange County, too, in the area. Groceries, all kinds of stuff.
I know those are the ones where they have the most kind of discretion because they're smaller and they can go and kind of get it where they need to.
That's right. And they're small, typically small purchasers. There are a couple of exceptions, fleet and information technology, that they have a little bit of larger spending threshold, but primarily it's for small goods.
So to the extent we can, we encourage them to buy Carver or Orange County.
Well, I would say that that's the likely place they're going to buy. They're going to go sometimes where the vendor is.
Right.
What if we made that better known that we would prefer, or that, I mean, we could even say that these cards are to be used within Orange County unless what you're looking for is not there? I mean, could we say that the cards, that we would strongly encourage employees to use the card inside Orange County?
Do you think that's too restrictive?
Well, I mean, there are examples. Let me give you some examples with information technology.
No, I mean, unless it's not available.
Right.
Unless it's not available. Because I can see somebody saying, oh, I want to run over to Durham, and I want to go to Borders, and I need this thing for the town, so I'll buy it at New Hope, the thing I need for the town, so I can hit Borders during lunch, which would be, you know, perfectly acceptable, perfectly understandable. But can we encourage... I'd like us to find a way to encourage employees to use that card inside Orange County unless they can show that what they need is not available inside the county.
I agree with that, and I think we already are doing a lot of that. I would suggest that maybe we not go to the point of, you know, a formal policy that says thou shalt must do it, because there might be something that we could find in Orange County, but it might not be exactly what the department might need. And there might be part A that you could get here locally, but there's a better part A that we've had experience with that would tell us that part A from someplace that might be outside of Orange County might be a better part. But I think most of our departments are already trying to do as much as we can locally, and there are things I think we can do to further encourage that. But we want to be careful, because one of the things about the procurement card has been it's taken a lot of the red tape out of purchasing, and it's allowed employees in the field to make quick decisions and get things
really
quickly.
I'm really in favor of that, I agree with that. I'd like to hear a way that we can strengthen encouraging employees to purchase within the county, because I think there are really good economic reasons to do that. I think we're seeing that Carrboro is stronger than some of our neighbors economically right now, and that's because, believe it or not, we're much more local of an economy than some of our neighbors are. So I think the town should be putting our money where our mouth is, and so I'd like to challenge you to come up with a way of encouraging employees to use those cards, unless there's a good, and I'm not saying create some horrible bureaucracy that they're going to hate, but, you know, if there's something that you notice everybody's going out of Carrboro for, maybe we can contact local vendors and say, look, our folks are going across county line. We would really, you know, is there any way you could be carrying that here, you know? So I'd really like us to work on it, because I think it's important.
Yeah, I just want to echo that second piece. I think is important, that the feedback that can go to local vendors who I think would see the town as an important customer and, you know, a very stable customer, perhaps a big customer, that, you know, if the question, you know, if a staff person knows, for example, that they have to go to Lowe's because they can't get something at Fitch's, that there could be a mechanism whereby we let Fitch know that, hey, you know, we'd like to be able to get this from you. And, you know, just so that.
Yeah. Let us work on that, because I think that's the part that probably, my guess is we could do a much better job, is giving feedback to local vendors to say, you know, we'd like to buy X, but you don't have X. Is
right.
there a way you can get X because we buy it?
Because we would be supporting our local economy, which is really important, and we would be cutting down on energy costs to go get things.
$470,000 is a lot to spend.
My question is about the second bullet there, and I think we've talked about this before, which is whether we can apply some factor of a multiplier effect to our definition of low-cost bid.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that it wouldn't just be that bottom line that we get from the vendor, but then we would take that and say, well, if we spent that locally, that's going to recirculate and add 20% value, or whatever the number would be, to the Carrboro economy, and that we could then factor that in. I mean, is there anything in the state definition, things looking at
no.
that would prevent us from doing that?
Yes, that the state statute, which requires that we Well, with respect to those things that are, that we take either formal or informal bids on, we're not required to do that. I mean, there's a statute with respect to those things that qualify as either formal or informal bids. You have to award it to the lowest responsible bidder or lowest responsive and responsible bidder. Mm-hmm. So,
but can we have a definition of what we consider lowest?
No. The state just describes what that is taking into account, and there's a little list, and it doesn't include where they come from.
Okay. So is it possible that we could get a local bill at some point that would allow us to do that, do you think? Or, I know, not this year.
Well, not this year. And I don't know whether or not there's a list of things, subjects that you're prohibited from getting local legislation on, and one of them is includes the word trade. So I don't know. I'd have to look at the statute and see, and ultimately probably they'd have to contact somebody over there, because those definitions are not, or those words are subject to interpretation sometimes. But I know that there's trade, manufacturing, and something else. There's a litany of three words in one of those subsections, and I don't remember. I remember trade specifically. So there may be a constitutional limitation, but I'm not sure about that.
Okay. So maybe that's something we can look into next winter when we get to close to our legislative agenda. Okay.
The opportunity for making those kinds of decisions exists with respect to things that are not covered by the purchasing laws, the statutes that require a bidding process. For example, the things we're buying, well, those cards probably don't. So the things that were that 400 and whatever it is subject to a policy, okay, which you've just described, basically.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Bing, I wanted to know if I'm looking at the last bullet under other criteria, whether or not the alternative fuel that the fleet vehicles use, if that's got to be outside of county, right?
I believe so.
Okay, so you know, I guess my question to the board really is, if we're looking at procuring alternative energy, would that be a priority over? So I just thrown it out because who knows what else is coming down the road. But would,
what? I don't understand the question.
Because if that's the only place it's available, right, then they can buy it out of county.
Right.
So it's kind of mute.
Okay. As long as, because I'm thinking, you know, if the priority is to purchase alternative fuels over something that is local, I just want to make sure that that's said.
Because a non-alternative fuel wouldn't be local by definition, right? It would have to come from,
well,
you know,
if we were to
Saudi Arabia or
no. But I mean, if we were to in the county, if we were to start to manufacture the biofuels here, the way they have in Chatham, it's purchased in Chatham, yeah. Isn't the
that's local. That's about as local. I mean, it's more local than Saudi Arabia.
Well, I agree with that.
But it's right down the road.
Yeah. I mean, but it's important that we did say that if it's not available in the county, then they can go out,
right,
of the county.
Okay. No. Any more questions on this topic? Jackie, you excuse me.
I'm fine.
Go on.
Okay, well, the next presentation is about banking. And the board had come up with the idea of moving assets to locally owned banks and or credit unions. In North Carolina, banking services are regulated. Statutes have specific requirements regarding public deposits and investments, and that's talking about the town's money or local municipality's money. And our investments as well. Banks are required to be a public depository, meaning that they meet certain banking requirements for ensuring the safety of public funds.
Bing?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That second bullet, does that mean that the banks you listed in here that are not public depositories in some way cannot be public depositories?
No, they can't.
They just haven't done what they need to do to be a public depository?
That's right, and I would explain that later, because there are a couple of banks that are not currently public depositors, but if they want to do business with the town, they would need to become public depositors, meaning they have to follow certain guidelines.
They just have to follow certain guidelines, but in and of what their size or how they're run, they're set so that they could be one if they got the contract or if they bid on the contract or whatever.
I think they have to follow some general statute requirements, and they're also subject to rules or guidelines from the local government commission. So it's mainly for our protection, taxpayers' protection.
Okay.
And then
but that has nothing to do with size. It's not that Bank of America had a law written saying that small banks can't. Okay.
No. And banks must secure our public deposits that are not insured by FDIC and through something called collateralization, and that protects us in case the bank goes under. And there are a couple of different methods in the state. One is dedicated, which requires municipalities to have expertise and perform a number of legal steps to make sure their money is protected. Or you can do the pooling method, which is highly suggested, and that's what we follow, which means that we have the local government commission watching, making sure our money is adequately collateralized. And I thank them for that.
And they do.
Here, and this was interesting, when I started looking at banks, and first I went through the yellow book pages and the phone book to see what banks were even in Orange County. And you can see here we have three branches in Carver. Almost all of the banks on this chart are in Orange County. But I will say there are a couple of interesting points about this chart. First, Hillsborough Bank and Harrington Bank have not reported any public funds, but that doesn't mean they can become public depositors, but they aren't at this point. None of the banks that were listed in a memo from the local government commission, I don't know if you saw that, none of them are listed as having corporate offices in North Carolina. Orange County. That's what I really meant to say. I'm sorry about that. I don't know about Harrington and Hillsborough. They're not on that list, so I don't know where their corporate offices are. And you'll also notice on this chart, many of the formerly local banks have been bought out or consumed by larger banks. I grew up with Central Carolina Bank, and that's now somewhere BB&T.
SunTrust.
Yeah, thank you, SunTrust. And an important note here is credit unions, while we have one in town, they are not legally allowed to be public depositories at this time.
When you say legally eligible, you're talking about North Carolina statutes only. Not
right.
Federal statutes.
No, I think it's North Carolina. I'm not sure, Mike. You mean I think I heard Vance Holloman from the local government commission say that this was a state issue.
That 22 states or credit unions in the United States can do the public depositories of local governments.
Okay.
I have a question.
I didn't know that.
If one of these banks did have their corporate office in Orange County, what additional financial benefit would that have for Orange County? I mean, you don't have sales tax, you know. They're here physically. You get property tax. Is there another kind of financial benefit that I'm unaware of? They're filing of some sort?
I don't know if there's a benefit. I think the point of being saying that was the board expressed an interest in doing business with a locally owned bank. And our research showed it's kind of difficult to figure out what that is. Harrington Bank, for example, which was mentioned, that bank was started by a holding company in Indiana. So, and I don't know what its status is now, but getting your arms around what's a local bank was difficult.
I guess my point in bringing this up last month was that the large banks, RBC, Bank of America, they are right now taking in as much money as they can and sitting on it in order to get their numbers up and their portfolio up. I'm wording it wrong, but I know what I'm talking about. They're bringing in money and holding it. They're not lending money. They are being very unscrupulous in their behavior towards small businesses. So my hope was that if we could find a smaller bank and give our money, the people's money, to a smaller bank, that would then be more open in its lending practices so that the flow of credit to our small businesses was more open and more real than what you're getting from Citibank and Bank of America, who really don't give a darn what happens to a small business in North Carolina, much less to a small business in Carrboro. So that if we could help leverage our own money in order to help our own businesses, I don't think that's such a cockeyed idea.
It's not.
And so I'd like us to start finding ways to do that. I had meant to call some bankers and talk about it, and just frankly haven't had the free time. I do think we need to begin agitation to allow the credit unions to be a place where we can put our money. That makes sense. Our employees bank there. They have a wonderful reputation for how they deal with folks. I don't think we have to be victim to and handmaiden to the huge corporate banks. I don't think it does us any good. It doesn't do us any more good than shopping at Walmart does us good. So I know it's not something that we can solve the problem this evening sitting here, but that doesn't mean that we can't begin to work towards shifting that paradigm. And the first way towards shifting that paradigm is to find a way to get away from the big banks, who really could care less about what's happening to our small businesses while they're taking our money and making money on it.
Jackie, I'm curious who you were going to call, because I think what this report indicates is that, as we all really know, is that there are no local banks. I mean, it would be wonderful if we had a Carrboro Bank and if it was eligible to receive the town's funds, but and that might be a great project for us to look into if the, you know, us as a board or the town could catalyze.
I was going to call that, one of the smaller banks. I don't want to say who I was going to call because I haven't called them yet.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I will say
a small bank, even though it's not necessarily a local bank.
Well, I want to learn more about them and about how local they are, and I don't want to. I don't want to put them in an awkward position.
That's fine.
Okay. But I think we really need to do something, you know?
I think pushing the credit union to look into how they can acquire those, meet those guidelines would be interesting.
Well, the credit union has to have a change in legislation.
Right.
And we can help them with that.
Right.
That help us.
Right.
Apparently, I researched this question, and it's kind of historical. You know, credit unions used to be, I mean, since the statute is so old, credit unions in those times were kind of loosely regulated financial institutions. So traditionally, only banks have been highly regulated, and, you know, that FDIC insured credit unions today are comparable, I believe, and they are federally insured. And they, but also, there's some issues about the collateralization of the funds. I mean, this is like overnight money, and credit unions are excellent serving their members and their local folks.
Right.
Banks, I mean, this is this pools of money are, I mean, we want our highest return, and we need to pull that money whenever we need it.
And we don't care what happens.
And in credit unions, that is it's not a, the most ideal kind of deposit you're looking for either. But we should consider, I mean, at some point credit unions, if let's say the city of, I mean, the town of Carrboro wants to start an IDA program and we want to do it with a local financial institution like our credit union, we should be able to do that. Legally today we cannot, which because the statute only says banks everywhere. It has to be explicitly said credit union or it's not legal.
I wonder who wrote those.
The bankers.
You know, it was written, though, in an earlier time before you had the separation, when you had the separation between investment banks and bank banks. And then you had the elimination of Glass-Steagall, which separated banks and investment banks, and now we sit.
So I'm really looking for us to find a way to leverage the town funds in a way that will be beneficial to the people that live in the town and have businesses in the town, and particularly in this era of squeezed credit and of kind of not too nice bankers. So I'm looking for a way for us to leverage that. The statement that we got from the banks was from 2003, I believe, you know, which was quite a while ago, about how much good they're doing for the community. Maybe if we can't find a local bank, we can go to some of the big banks and say, how are you treating our local businesses? How are you treating them? If you're not treating them too nice, maybe we have some other friends. Okay.
And I think you're really getting to the point I was going to suggest at the end, and thinking about banking and businesses, what the town needs financially from banking services and debt financing is perhaps, you know, and I guess I'll go back and do the other part of the presentation if you'd like me to, but the question I think it gets at is, should we drive the town's business decision, banking services, finances, based on banking relationships with local business? Are there other ways to accomplish a similar initiative? And also the last question, thinking through, will the town's assets in a bank influence decisions made by the bank regarding local business relationships and financing? And I will say I had a conversation with someone at the local government commission that oversees banking operations, and I asked that last question and said, you know, if we move our assets to a bank, do you think that would, you know, then turn into money where businesses could borrow more easily? And she said, not likely, but that the reality is that businesses are going to get money based on their credit quality. However, I would acknowledge that if there's a relationship and perhaps ongoing forums, we talked to Bank of America, and they're willing to do forums in the community, help businesses, and I've shared that information with James Harris. Also, Bank of America, and that's who we bank with. They have, if we do have a local branch, and they also have a Spanish interpreter there because they recognize the need at the bank.
What I'm talking about is that the banks are squeezing credit. I'm not talking about the banks going out and playing Lady Bountiful.
Okay.
You know, or coming in and doing good deeds. That's easy. Right. I'm talking about the banks doing what we need banks to do, which is having functional, fair working relationships with our businesses. And that's not happening with the large banks right now. That's one of the problems local communities are having. Now, what good will it do? Well, Carrboro was the first municipality to pass a resolution asking for a moratorium on the death penalty. Everybody went, what's that going to do? Well, North Carolina had a moratorium on the death penalty. And maybe if municipalities start going to banks and saying, how are you treating our local businesses? If you're not treating our local businesses in a fair and equitable way that's profiting our local economic community, then we're going to go find another bank. So I'm talking about using leverage to get fair treatment and credit for our businesses who need it, and I think that is rational and that is doable.
And
I think also that part of the implication of what you're saying is that we really need a different kind of bank that we have currently. Like over the holidays, like everyone else, I was watching the Wonderful Life movie, and there's that great scene where there's the run on the bank and everyone wants their money, and Jimmy Stewart says, well, Joe, you can't have your money because your money is in Jimmy's farm and your money is in his store and all that. And, you know, and yeah, that, you know, that sounds really quaint perhaps today, but the fact is that that's the kind of system that's you're it. Describing. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about our whole emphasis on local economy, that really, you know, I think we'd like to have a bank like that. And if we could figure out a way to have one in Carrboro and to have it be qualified to hold and invest the town's funds, that would really be ideal. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think having that idea as a potential goal contradicts wanting to look at changing the rules for credit unions or trying to hold the banks we have now more accountable.
But in the meantime, let's see if we can get the banks that we're working with now to treat our businesses better, and that can mean going to Bank of America and saying, hey, this other bank has a better credit flow and better policies and is more flexible with small businesses than you are. What are you going to do? I think we do have that kind of leverage while we're getting ready to build Jimmy Stewart's bank.
Yeah, and so Bing, following up on on Jackie's point, are we scheduled at any point soon to actually revisit that question? I think you said it was like in 2003 or something when we picked Bank of America. Are we scheduled to revisit that and take bids again?
Our banking services contract expires in February 2010, and what that will involve is, again, doing another RFP, request for proposal. And I had mentioned in the presentation, I'm kind of jumping all around as the conversation moves, but it's possible that a future banking proposal could seek more information on the bank's involvement in the community and what types of local business support is available, and something that would give us more information to make our decisions about selecting a bank. And so we will be doing that in the upcoming year.
Okay. Steve, would you consider it appropriate tonight for us to have a resolution requesting that that be done as part of that RFP? Or would you rather have time to reflect on it and give us more information first? Because I would like to pursue that.
Unless Bing knows the reason, I have no problem with the board asking us to include that. I think we would have done it anyway, given the conversation from the retreat and tonight. But if the board wants to put that in the form of a resolution, I don't see a problem. There'll be a lot of other things that we'll come back to you, things that we feel like, you know, from a legal standpoint and from a protection standpoint for our assets, we'll need to have included. But I think that's entirely reasonable.
Okay. Well, I'd like to make that resolution, which is basically the wording here, to say that a future banking proposal will seek information on the bank's involvement in the community, as particularly as a lender to both residents and to businesses.
And second.
I'll second.
Randy seconds, and those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? This resolution passes unanimously.
I would encourage small businesses that have had experiences with these banks to share those experiences with us so that we can get both sides of the story.
Okay. I had planned on doing some presentation about our banking services and investments, but if y'all don't need that, I'm happy to stop, or because that is in your report.
It is. Okay. Is that, unless anybody has burning desire questions on that topic?
Okay. I move to accept the report.
I have another issue.
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
Can you, can you all
am I the only one who has another issue they want to talk
about?
Oh, is there a separate report?
No, it's part of the same report.
Okay, there's a resolution to accept the whole report in the packet. Is that what you're moving?
Right.
Okay.
You still have questions on the report?
The report is in the packet. It's about everything we talked about.
So let's address your question first.
Well, then go ahead.
Just banking or the whole retreat?
The whole retreat.
I had some other issues with the whole retreat.
I'll hold it.
So,
yeah.
Well, let's just go to those then.
Okay.
Thank you. I know this isn't what you were expecting. And
well, that's okay. And we'll continue to ask Bank of America to work with us. I think they
will. Our businesses.
Right.
Okay. Do we have anything with RBC?
We may have a financing, a debt financing.
The Royal Bank of Canada?
A robber baron corporation.
They're a lot better than American banks right now.
Well, they have different. The Canadian system is, no, actually the Canadian system is very different in terms of how they loan money for houses and what their tax code is like.
Right, but RBC is not necessarily reflecting that in their dealings. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Dan.
Yeah, I had a point on item six, which was the green building industry. And, Steve, you said you'd wanted additional discussion. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a couple things I wanted to say about that. One is that a year ago at our retreat, we made it our top priority for last year, the whole green jobs initiative. And James did some really good work getting some things going initially in terms of getting the educational pieces together, and I guess we had that event at the Town Commons in September. But it seems like there's a next step that has to do with actually catalyzing some business in Carrboro and getting workers in Carrboro engaged in those businesses that, as far as I'm aware, we haven't looked at yet. And so that my first question would be, you know, what all report you might be, or update you might have on that, or if you have anticipation of activities for 09 or a planning process that we should know about. The other thing is more specific, and it's recalling that Chapel Hill, a few years ago, earlier this decade, had a bond measure for energy improvements for the town that was passed by the citizens. And I'm not sure what all they did with that, but it was energy improvements for public buildings and public spaces in the town. And it seems like today there's an even greater opportunity in terms of creating alternative energy on town property and selling energy into the grid, and that those bonds are perhaps potentially self-financing, if that's the right term, self-liquidating in terms of what you get from them. So I'm interested in whether, and maybe that's not a question we can answer tonight, but I'm interested in whether that's something that we could do to help create additional business in Carrboro, because if, you know, if the town's helping create demand in that way, and also continuing in that kind of manner to highlight the importance of these businesses and the benefits that can be gained, I think that would be a really good thing. So I guess those are two points I'm asking.
Okay, well, the second question first, I don't know really anything about what Chapel Hill did, so I'm not in the position, I don't know if anybody else on staff is in a position to respond to how we might do something similar, going to the public with any kind of a bond issue in the near term would need to be very well thought out, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's something we could certainly look at.
Okay.
On the first part, I'm going to ask James if he has any update now, or if that's something we can get back to you on.
I think we need to get back to you on that. We've been working on some things, and I think we just need to pull a report to bring to you.
Okay, great. Jackie?
I just had two quick things. One is on A2, where we're talking about giving notification to agencies after they've been awarded our human services money. I'd just like it, Mike, on the record to be part of our procedures, that as soon as the board votes, which is usually mid-June, that within a week, notification will go out to the agencies of what their allocation was. I'd like us to officially do that, because sometimes folks really, really, really have to wait quite a while, and they need the information for their budget. So I'd just like to throw that out there and make that request. And the other thing is under community gardens, which I think was for our community gardens is C4. We had years ago a community garden in Baldwin Park over on Broad Street. We plowed up the land every spring, so that folks could go in there and garden. And it wasn't used a lot, and so it kind of fell by the wayside. But, you know, there are young families there again, and it might be a good time to look at that, particularly considering the overwhelming participation and enthusiasm that's greeted the community park in at the MLK Park. And Baldwin Park is, you know, right in a dense residential area, a lot of families and older folks living there, and wouldn't cost that much money. All we did was put a fence around it and plow it up and let folks have at it. So I'd like to look at reinvigorating the Baldwin Park community garden if the board so desires.
Lydia?
I have two comments. One is, in this report, the characterization of reassessing commercial usage in Northern Carrboro is a long-term goal. And I know I know that there's a lot of work going into it. I know I bug Trish about it all the time. I know I talk to Roy about it all the time. But it's just so important to, because as soon as we get to it, then it's going to take forever to do it and forever to implement it. And I just, that word long-term makes me a little nervous. I just want to see it come before us sooner than later.
Well, if you look, I mean, the target for completion is this coming fiscal year.
Well, the target for completion is next fiscal year, right? 09-10
Yeah, this coming fiscal year, right? 9-10
And the second question I have is
you mean next fiscal year, 9-10
Yeah, the one coming up. Yeah,
it's coming. We're in
2009, 2010
Yes, Dan. It's just that if it does come in 9-10 and then we'll have to implement it, and then we'll have to, you know, it is what it is. The second thing is I wondered about the internet access beyond Main Street. I wondered if there was anything remarkable that happened today, if you were able to catch the webcast.
I didn't catch it, but Matt did, and he's still plowing through 35 pages of a lot of technical stuff in addition to the webinar. I'll be pretty blunt and say it's unlikely that there's much there for Carrboro. I think it's really targeted towards the rural areas. And it, at first glance, and correct me, Matt, if I misstate anything, I think it looks like there'd be a whole lot of work for not a lot of return for more urban areas, particularly when you look at we have two IT people that do it all.
Okay.
Go ahead, Randy. Move the resolution.
I move that we accept the report.
Second.
Move and second. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
That includes with comments, right?
Yes. With all the comments.
Yes. Any from the staff, any items?
No, just say we on the items you've asked for follow up, we'll get back to you ASAP on the green jobs and we will move forward on banking. Because vote 10 will be here soon. So.
Thank you.
Second.
Second, say aye.
Aye.
Close. Meeting is adjourned.